चैप्टर 38 बिजनेस साइकिल्स पेज 331 मीनिंग बिजनेस साइकिल और ट्रेड साइकिल इज अ पार्ट ऑफ द कैपिटलिस्ट सिस्टम इट रिफर्स टू द फिनोमेना ऑफ साइक्लिकल बूम्स एंड डिप्रेशंस इन अ बिजनेस साइकिल देर आर वेव लाइक फ्लक्चुएशंस इन एग्रीगेट एम्प्लॉयमेंट इनकम आउटपुट एंड प्राइस लेवल द टर्म बिजनेस साइकिल हैज बीन डिफाइंड इन वेरियस वेज बाई डिफरेंट इकोनॉमिस्ट्स Professor Harberler's definition is very simple. The business cycle in the general sense may be defined as an alternation of periods of prosperity and depression, of good and bad trade. Keynes's definition in his treatise of money is more explicit. A trade cycle is composed of periods of good trade characterized by rising prices and low unemployment percentage, alternating with periods of bad trade characterized by falling prices and high unemployment percentages. Gordon's definition is precise. Business cycles consist of recurring alternation of expansion and contraction in aggregate economic activity, the alternating movements in each direction being self-reinforcing and pervading virtually all parts of the economy. The most acceptable definition is by Este. Cyclical fluctuations are characterized by alternating waves of expansion and contraction. They do not have a fixed rhythm, but they are cycles in that the phases of contraction and expansion recur frequently and in fairly similar patterns. Note 1, J.A.S.T. Business Cycles, 1956. Types of business cycles. Business cycles are usually classified as under 1. The short kitchen cycle. It is also known as the minor cycle, which is of approximately 40 months duration. It is famous after the name of the British economist Joseph Kitchen, who made a distinction between a major and a minor cycle in 1923. He came to the conclusion on the basis of his research that a major cycle is composed of two or three minor cycles of 40 months. 2. The long juggler cycle. This cycle is also known as the major cycle. It is defined as a fluctuation of business activity between successive crises. In 1862, Clement Juggler, French economist, showed that periods of prosperity, crisis, and liquidation followed each other always in the same order. Later economists have come to the conclusion that a juggler's cycle's duration is on the average 9.5 years. 3. The very long Kondratiev cycle. In 1925, N.D. Kondratiev, the Russian economist, came to the conclusion that there are longer waves or cycles of more than 50 years duration made of 6 juggler cycles. A very long cycle has been come to known as the Kondratiev wave. 4. Building cycles. Another type of cycle relates to the construction of buildings, which is of fairly regular duration. Its duration is twice that of the major cycles and is on an average of 18 years duration. Such cycles are associated with names of Warren and Pearson. 5. Kuznets cycle. Simon Kuznets propounded a new type of cycle, the secular swing of 16 to 22 years, which is so pronounced that it dwarfs the 7 to 11 year cycle in relative insignificance. This has come to be known as the Kuznets cycle. Characteristics of business cycles. Business cycles possess the following characteristics. 1. Cyclical fluctuations are wave-like movements. 2. Fluctuations are recurrent in nature. Page 332. 3. They are non-periodic or irregular. In other words, the peaks and troughs do not occur at regular intervals. 4. They occur in such aggregate variables as output, income, employment, and prices. 5. These variables move at about the same time, in the same direction, but at different rates. 6. The durable goods industries experience relatively wide fluctuations in output and employment, but relatively small fluctuations in prices. On the other hand, non-durable goods industries experience relatively wide fluctuations in prices but relatively small fluctuations in output and employment. 7. Business cycles are not seasonal fluctuations such as upswings in retail trade during Diwali or Christmas. 8. They are not secular trends such as long-run growth or decline in economic activity. And 9. Upswings and downswings are cumulative in their effects. Thus, business cycles are recurrent fluctuations in aggregate employment, income, output, and price level. Phases of a business cycle. A typical cycle is generally divided into four phases. 1. Expansion or prosperity or the upswing. 2. Recession or upper turning point. 3. Contraction or depression or downswing. And 4. Revival or recovery or the lower turning point. These phases are recurrent and uniform in the case of different cycles, but no phase has definite periodicity or time interval. As pointed out by PGO, cycles may not be twins, but they are of the same family. Like families, they have common characteristics that are capable of description. Starting at the trough or low point, a cycle passes through a recovery and prosperity phase, rises to a peak, declines through a recession and depression phase, and reaches a trough. This is shown in figure 1, where E is the equilibrium position. So in figure 1, we have time on the x-axis and economic activity on the y-axis. There is a E curve, which is a straight line curve at a very small angle to the x-axis, a rising curve. Now we have a wave which is drawn about the E curve. So it starts from a point on the y-axis where E meets the y-axis. The curve or the wave is a downward curve. Then it reaches the minimum point called a trough. After the trough, the wave starts rising. So this is known as the recovery phase till it reaches the E line. When it goes beyond the E line, the curve is called the prosperity phase till it reaches the peak. After the peak, the curve starts again going down till it reaches the E line. It is called recession. When it crosses the E line and reaches the lowermost point, it is called depression phase, and the lowermost point is called a trough. So the recovery process starts once again, the curve starts going up, and then it is a prosperity, and so on. We describe these characteristics of a business cycle. Recovery. We start from a situation when depression has lasted for some time and the revival phase or the low turning point starts. The originating forces or starters may be exogenous or endogenous forces. Suppose the semi-durable goods wear out, which necessitate their replacement in the economy. It leads to increased demand. To meet this increased demand, investment and employment increase. Industry begins to revive. Revival also starts in related capital goods industries. Once begun, the process of revival becomes cumulative. As a result, the levels of employment, input and output rise steadily in the economy. In the early stages of the revival phase, there is considerable excess or idle capacity in the economy so that output increases without a proportionate increase in total costs. But as time goes out, output becomes less elastic. Bottlenecks appear with rising costs, deliveries are more difficult, and plants may have to be expanded. Under these conditions, prices rise, profits increase, business expectations improve, optimism prevails, investment is encouraged, which tends to raise the demand for bank loans. It leads to credit expansion. Thus, the cumulative process of increase in investment, employment, output, income, and prices feeds upon itself and becomes self-reinforcing. Ultimately, revival enters the prosperity phase. Prosperity. In the prosperity phase, demand, output, employment, and income are at a high level. They tend to raise prices, but wages, salaries, interest rates, rentals, and taxes do not rise in proportion to the rise in prices. The gap between prices and costs increase the margin of profit. The increase of profit and the prospect of its continuance commonly cause a rapid rise in stock market values. The economy is engulfed in waves of optimism. Page 333. Larger profit expectations further increase investment, which is helped by liberal bank credit. Such investments are mostly in fixed capital, plant, equipment and machinery. They lead to considerable expansion in economic activity by increasing the demand for consumer goods and further raising the price level. This encourages retailers, wholesalers and manufacturers to add to inventories. In this way, the expansionary process becomes cumulative and self-reinforcing until the economy reaches a very high level of production known as the peak or boom. The peak or prosperity may lead the economy to over full employment and to inflationary rise in prices. It is a symptom of the end of the prosperity phase and the beginning of recession. The seeds of recession are contained in the boom in the form of strains in the economic structure, which act as brakes to the expansionary path. They are 1. Scarcities of labor, raw materials, etc., leading to rise in costs relative to prices. 2. Rise in the rate of interest due to scarcity of capital. And 3. Failure of consumption to rise due to rising prices and stable propensity to consume when incomes increase. The first factor brings a decline in profit margins. The second makes investments costly, and along with the first, lowers business expectations. The third factor leads to the piling up of inventories, indicating that sales or consumption lag behind production. These forces become cumulative and self-reinforcing. Entrepreneurs, businessmen and traders become overcautious, and over-optimism gives way to pessimism. This is the beginning of the upper turning point. Recession. Recession starts when there is a downward descent from the peak, which is of a short duration. It marks the turning period during which the forces that make for contraction finally win over the forces of expansion. Its outward signs are liquidation in the stock market, strain in the banking system, and some liquidation of bank loans, and the beginning of the decline of prices. As a result, profit margins decline further because costs start overtaking prices. Some firms close down. Others reduce production and try to sell out accumulated stocks. Investment, employment, income and demand decline. This process becomes cumulative. Recession may be mild or severe. The latter might lead to a sudden explosive situation emanating from the banking system or the stock exchange, and a panic or crisis occurs. When a crisis, and more particularly a panic, does occur, it seems to be associated with a collapse of confidence and sudden demands for liquidity. This crisis of nerves may itself be occasioned by some spectacular and unexpected failure. A firm or a bank or a corporation announces its inability to meet its debts. This announcement weakens other firms and banks at a time when ominous signs of distress are appearing in the economic structure. Moreover, it sets off a wave of fright which culminates in a general run on financial institutions. Such was the experience of the United States in 1873, in 1893, in 1907, and recently in 2008. In the words of M. W. Lee, a recession once started tends to build upon itself much as forest fire. Once underway, tends to create its own draft and give internal impetus to its destructive ability. Note 2, M. W. Lee, Economic Fluctuations, 1955. Depression. Recession merges into depression when there is a general decline in economic activity. There is considerable reduction in the production of goods and services, employment, income, demands and prices. The general decline in economic activity leads to fall in bank deposits. Credit expansion stops because the business community is not willing to borrow. Bank rate falls considerably. According to Professor Este, this fall in active purchasing power is the fundamental background of the fall in prices that, despite the general reduction of output, characterizes the depression. Thus, a depression is characterized by mass unemployment, general fall in prices, profits, wages, interest rate, consumption, expenditure, investment, bank deposits and loans. Factories close down and construction of all types of capital goods, buildings, etc. comes to a standstill. These factors are cumulative and self-reinforcing, and the economy is at the trough. The trough or depression may be short-lived, or it may continue at the bottom for considerable time. But sooner or later, limiting forces are set in motion which ultimately tend to bring the contraction phase to end and pave the way for the revival. A cycle is thus complete. Causes of business cycles. During the last several hundred years, philosophers, economists, stockbrokers and men in the street have tried to give various causes of business cycles. Some attribute them to monetary and non-monetary factors, while others to psychological factors. Samuelson attributes business cycles to external and internal factors, which we explain below. Page 334. External factors. The external factors emphasize the causes of business cycles in the fluctuations of something outside the economic system. Such external factors are sunspots, wars, revolutions, political events, gold discoveries, growth rate of population, migrations, discoveries and innovations. These outside factors change the level of national income by affecting either the investment or consumption component of aggregate demand. For example, a drought that destroys many crops due to sunspots may reduce the quantity of goods produced in the country and adversely affect both consumption and investment. An innovation by opening the door to new markets, raw materials, products and production processes encourages new investments in plant and equipment. Inventions of railroads, electricity, telephone, automobiles, TVs, computers, etc. have led to the burst of investments in both capital and consumer goods from time to time. Discoveries of gold, oil and natural resources have led to large-scale investments. Similarly, population expansion and migrations are the causes of huge investments in both housing and other infrastructure and consumer durables. All the above noted external factors have been responsible for booms in business cycles from time to time. Internal factors. The internal factors relate to mechanisms within the economic system itself, which will give rise to self-generating business cycles, so that every expansion will breed recession and contraction, and every contraction will in turn breed revival and expansion in a quasi-regular, repeating, never-ending chain. Note 3. P. A. Samuelson, Economics, page 293. Harberler divides the internal factors into monetary and non-monetary, which we briefly explain. 1. Bank credit. Hawthorne, Friedman and other monetarists regard business cycle as a purely monetary phenomena. According to Hawthorne, cyclical fluctuations are caused by expansion and contraction of bank credit. These in turn lead to changes in the demand for money on the part of producers and traders. Bank credit is the principal means of payment. Credit is expanded or reduced by the banks by lowering or raising the rate of interest or by purchasing and selling of securities to traders. This increases or decreases the supply of money in the economy. An increase in the money supply brings about prosperity, and a decrease in the money supply leads to depression. 2. Oversaving or underconsumption. According to economists like Hobson, Foster and Douglas, business cycles are caused by oversaving or underconsumption. They argue that wide disparities of income and wealth lead to depression in the country. The rich people are not able to spend their entire income, so they save more and invest more in producing consumer goods. On the other hand, the poor people have low incomes or wages. As a result, their demand for consumer goods is low, which means that there is underconsumption. According to Hobson, oversaving leads to production of consumer goods in large quantities and to a boom. But underconsumption on the part of the workers due to low wages brings a fall in the demand for consumer goods. Stocks pile up at the current level of prices. These in turn lead to a fall in the prices of consumer goods and in the income of the producers. As a result, depression sets in. 3. Overinvestment. Hayek, Spentoff, Cassell and Robertson find the root cause of business cycles in overinvestment. According to Hayek, it is bank loans which lead to overinvestment in capital goods industries relative to consumer goods industries that ultimately brings a depression in the economy. When the total money supply exceeds the amount of voluntary savings, it leads to increase in the investment activity and ultimately to a boom. But banks cannot continue to give credit for long due to the shortage of voluntary savings. As a result, production will decline, which will bring about a depression. Thus, it is overinvestment in the capital goods industries which is the cause of a boom and a depression. 4. Competition. According to Chapman, the main cause of business cycles is the existence of competition in an economy which leads to overproduction and ultimately to a crisis, that is depression. Under competitive conditions, firms produce in anticipation of demand. The profit motive attracts new firms. Production increases and boom starts. Competition and profits lead to overproduction and glut of commodities in the market and to fall in prices. On the other hand, the race to produce more and profit more on the part of producers increases the demands for factors of production. Competition among producers to hire more factors raises their prices. Thus, costs rise, which raise the prices of products. Demands fall, and there is a glut of commodities which eventually leads to fall in prices and to a depression. Page 335. 5. Psychological causes. According to Pigeau, the alternating waves of over-optimism and over-pessimism are the sole causes of industrial fluctuations. He traces cyclical fluctuations to the tendency of businessmen to react excessively to the changing conditions of the economy. It is this tendency that causes alternating periods of overproduction and underproduction. Errors of optimism and pessimism are interacting forces. As soon as the business community discovers that it has made an error of optimism, it tries to correct it by making errors of pessimism. Each phase of the cycle produces a state of psychology which produces forces that bring about a reversal of that psychology and in turn another reversal. These alternating waves of over-optimism, that is overproduction, and over-pessimism, that is underproduction, as a result of these reversals, are the main causes of business cycles. 6. Innovations. According to Schumpeter, innovations in the structure of an economy are the source of economic fluctuations. To him, the cause of depression is prosperity. The boom consists in carrying out of innovations in the industrial and commercial fields. The cyclical upswing is set in motion when an innovator starts making investment in his innovation of a new product. This enables him to make profit. Soon other entrepreneurs adopt this new product in swarm-like clusters. Innovations in one field induce innovations in related fields. There is large increase in the output of new products. Consequently, money incomes and prices rise and help to create a cumulative expansion in the economy. Over-optimism adds further to the boom. When there is a glut of new products in the market, their prices fall and profit margins of entrepreneurs are reduced. Banks asked for repayment of loans. The quantity of money is reduced and prices fall further. Some entrepreneurs cut down production and others are forced into liquidation. Thus, the economy enters into depression. 7. Marginal efficiency of capital, MEC. According to Keynes, the cycle consists primarily of fluctuations in the rate of investment. And fluctuations in the rate of investment are caused mainly by fluctuations in the MEC. The MEC depends on the supply price of capital assets and their prospective yield. The supply price of capital assets being stable in the short run, the MEC is determined by the prospective yield of capital assets. The prospective yield in turn depends on business expectations. Fluctuations in the rate of investment are also caused by fluctuations in the rate of interest. but it is fluctuations in the MEC which are the principal cause of cyclical fluctuations. Conclusion. To conclude with Samuelson, business cycles are caused both by external and internal factors. The economic system responds to fluctuations in external factors according to its internal factors and vice versa. Effects of business cycles. Business cycles have both good and bad effects depending upon whether the economy is passing through a phase of prosperity or depression. In the prosperity phase, the real income consumed, real income produced, and the level of employment are high or rising, and there are no idle or unemployed workers or very few of either. There is general increase in economic activity. Aggregate output, demand, employment, and income are at a high level. Prices are rising, profits are increasing, stock markets are rapidly reaching new heights. Investments are increasing with liberal bank credit. This entire process is cumulative and self-reinforcing. But different sections of the society are affected differently during the prosperity phase. The landless, factory and agricultural workers and middle classes suffer because their wages and salaries are more or less fixed, but the prices of commodities rise continuously. They become more poor. On the other hand, businessmen, traders, industrialists, real estate holders, speculators, landlords, shareholders, and others with variable incomes gain. Thus, the rich become richer and the poor poorer. The social effects are also bad. Lured by profit, there is hoarding, black marketing, adulteration, production of substandard goods, speculation, etc. Corruption spreads in every walk of life. When the economy is nearing the full employment level of resources, the ill effects on production start appearing. Rising prices of raw materials and increase in wage raise costs of production. As a result, profit margins decline. There is a rise in interest rates due to scarcity of capital, which makes investment costly. Page 336. These two factors lower business expectations. Lastly, the demand for consumer goods does not rise due to inflationary rise in prices. This leads to piling up of inventories or stocks with producers and traders. Thus, sales lag behind production. There is decline in prices. Producers, businessmen and traders become pessimists and the recession starts. During recession, profit margins decline further because costs start rising more than prices. Some firms close down. Others reduce production and try to sell accumulated stocks. Investment, output, employment, income, demand and prices decline further. This process becomes cumulative and recession merges into depression. During a depression, there is mass unemployment. Prices, profits and wages are at their lowest levels. Demand for goods and services is the minimum. Investment, bank deposits and bank loans are negligible. Construction of all types of capital goods, buildings, etc. is at a standstill. There is mass unemployment in the economy. The government revenues from direct and indirect taxes decline. The real burden of debt increases. Economic development of the country suffers. Theories of business cycles. In fact, the causes of business cycles given above are based on the theories of business cycles propounded by economists from time to time. We discuss some of the important theories as under. 1. Hautre's monetary theory. According to Professor R. G. Hautre, the trade cycle is a purely monetary phenomena. It is changes in the flow of monetary demand on the part of businessmen that lead to prosperity and depression in the economy. He opines that non-monetary factors like strikes, floods, earthquakes, droughts, wars, etc. may at best cause a partial depression, but not a general depression. In actuality, cyclical fluctuations are caused by expansion and contraction of bank credit, which in turn lead to variations in the flow of monetary demand on the part of producers and traders. Bank credit is the principal means of payment in the present times. Credit is expanded or reduced by the banking system by lowering or raising the rate of interest, or by producing or selling securities to merchants. This increases or decreases the flow of money in the economy and thus brings about prosperity or depression. The expansion phase of the trade cycle starts when banks increase credit facilities. They are provided by reducing the lending time of interest and by purchasing securities. These encourage borrowings on the part of merchants and producers. This is because they are very sensitive to changes in the rate of interest. So when credit becomes cheap, they borrow from banks in order to increase their stocks or inventories. For this, they place larger orders with producers, who in turn employ more factors of production to meet the increasing demand. Consequently, money incomes of the owners of factors of production increase, thereby increasing expenditure on goods. The merchants find their stocks being exhausted. They place more orders with producers. This leads to further increase in productive activity, income, outlay and demand, and a further depletion of stocks of merchants. According to Hawtrey, increased activity means increased demand, and increased demand means increased activity. A vicious circle is set up, a cumulative expansion of productive activity. As the cumulative process of expansion continues, producers quote higher and higher prices. Higher prices induce traders to borrow more in order to hold still larger stocks of goods so as to earn more profits. Thus, optimism encourages borrowing, borrowing increases sales, and sales raise optimism. According to Hawtrey, prosperity cannot continue limitlessly. It comes to an end when banks stop credit expansion. Banks refuse to lend further because their cash funds are depleted and the money in circulation is absorbed in the form of cash holdings by consumers. Another factor is the export of gold to other countries when imports exceed exports as a result of high prices of domestic goods. These factors force the banks to raise interest rates and refuse to lend. Rather, they ask the business community to repay their loans. This starts the recessionary phase. In order to repay bank loans, businessmen start selling their stocks. This sets the process of falling prices. They also cancel orders with producers. The latter curtail their productive activities due to foreign demand. These in turn lead to reduction in the demand for factors of production. There is unemployment. Incomes fall. Falling demand, prices and incomes are the signals for depression. Unable to repay bank loans, some firms go into liquidation, thus forcing banks to contract credit further. Thus, the entire process becomes cumulative and the economy is forced into depression. Page 337. According to Hawtrey, the process of recovery is very slow and halting. As depression continues, traders repay bank loans by selling their stocks at whatever prices they can. As a result, money flows into the reserves of banks and funds increase with banks. Even though the bank rate is very low, there is credit deadlock, which prevents businessmen to borrow from banks due to pessimism in economic activity. This deadlock can be broken by following a cheap money policy by the central bank, which will ultimately bring about recovery in the economy. Its criticisms. Monetarists like Friedman have supported Hawtrey's theory, but the majority of economists have criticized him for overemphasizing monetary factors to the neglect of non-monetary factors in explaining cyclical fluctuations. Some of the points of criticism are discussed below. 1. Credit not the cause of cycle. None can deny that expansion of credit leads to the expansion of business activity. But Hawtrey believes that an expansion of credit leads to a boom. This is not correct because the former is not the key cause of the latter. As pointed out by Piggio, variations in the bank money supply is a part of business cycle. It is not the cause of it. At the bottom of the depression, credit is easily available. Even then, it fails to bring a revival. Similarly, contraction of credit cannot bring about a depression. At best, it can create conditions for that. Thus, expansion or contraction of credit cannot originate either boom or depression in the economy. 2. Money supply cannot continue a boom or delay a depression. Haberler has criticized Hawtrey for his contention that the reason for the breakdown of the womb is always a monetary one, and that prosperity could be prolonged and depression stayed off indefinitely if the money supply were inexhaustible. Note 5. G. Haberler, Business Cycles, pages 27-28. But the fact is that even if the supply of money is inexhaustible in the country, neither prosperity can be continued indefinitely nor depression can be delayed indefinitely. 3. Traders do not depend only on bank credit. Hamburg, note 6. D. Hamburg, Business Cycles, 1937. Hamburg has criticized Hawtrey for the role assigned to wholesalers in his analysis. The kingpin in Hawtrey's theory is the trader or the wholesaler who gets credit from banks and starts the upturn or vice versa. In actuality, traders do not depend exclusively on bank credit, but they finance business through their own accumulated funds and borrowing from private sources. 4. Traders do not react to changes in interest rates. Further, Hamburg also does not agree with Hawtrey that traders react to changes in interest rates. According to Hamburg, traders are likely to react favorably to a reduction in the interest rate only if they think that the reduction is permanent. But they do not react favorably during the depression phase because traders expect a further reduction every time the interest rate is reduced. On the other hand, if traders finance their stocks with their own funds, interest rate changes will have little effect on their purchases. 5. Factors other than interest rate more important. It is an exaggeration to say that the decisions of traders regarding accumulation or depletion of stocks are solely governed by changes in interest rate. As a matter of fact, factors other than the rate of interest are more important in influencing such decisions. They are business expectations, price changes, cost of storage, etc. 6. Inventory investments do not produce true cycles. Hamburg further points out that in Hawtrey's theory, cumulative movements in economic activity are the result of changes in stocks of goods. But fluctuations in inventory investment can at best produce minor cycles, which are not cycles in the true sense of the term. 7. Does not explain periodicity of cycle. The theory also fails to explain the periodicity of the cycle. 8. Ignores non-monetary factors. Hawtrey's theory is incomplete because it emphasizes only monetary factors and totally ignores such non-monetary factors as innovations, capital stock, multiplier-accelerator interaction, etc. Page 338. 2. Hayek's monetary overinvestment theory. F. A. Hayek formulated his monetary overinvestment theory of trade cycle. He explained his theory on the basis of Wicksell's distinction between the natural interest rate and the market interest rate. The natural rate of interest is that rate at which the demand for loanable funds equals the supply of voluntary savings. On the other hand, the market rate of interest is the money rate which prevails in the market and is determined by the demand and supply of money. According to Hayek, so long as the natural rate of interest equals the market rate of interest, the economy remains in the state of equilibrium and full employment. Trade cycles in the economy are caused by inequality between market and natural interest rates. When the market interest rate is less than the natural rate, there is prosperity in the economy. On the contrary, when the market interest rate is more than the natural rate, the economy is in depression. According to this theory, prosperity begins when the market rate of interest is less than the natural rate of interest. In such a situation, the demand for investment funds is more than the supply of available savings. The demand for investment funds is met by the increase in the supply of money. As a result, the interest rates falls. Low interest rates induces producers to get more loans from banks. The producers get more loans to invest for the production of more capital goods. They adopt capital-intensive methods for producing more of the capital goods. As a result, production costs fall and profits increase. The production process becomes very lengthy with the adoption of capital-intensive methods. This has the effect of increasing the prices of capital goods in comparison to consumer goods. There being full employment in the economy, they transfer factors of the production from consumer goods sector to capital goods sector. Consequently, the production of consumer goods falls, their prices increase, and their consumption decreases. Forced savings increase with the fall in consumption, which are invested for the production of capital goods. This leads to increase in their production. On the other hand, with increase in the prices of consumer goods, their producers earn more profits. Induced by high profits, they try to produce more. For this, they pay higher remuneration to factors of production in comparison with the producers of capital goods. There being competition between two sectors, prices of factors and prices in the economy continue to rise. This leads to the atmosphere of prosperity in the country, and monetary overinvestment on factors spreads the boom. According to Hayek, when the prices of factors are rising continuously, the rise in production costs bring fall in the profit of producers. The producers of capital goods invest less in the expectation of loss in the future. Consequently, the natural interest rate falls. Simultaneously, banks impose restrictions on giving loans to them. With low profits and reduction in loans, producers reduce the production of capital goods and adopt labor-intensive production processes. There is less investment in capital goods. Production process being small and labor-intensive, the demand for money is reduced, which increases the market interest rate, which is more than the natural interest rate. Producers transfer the factors from production of capital goods to that of consumer goods. But more factors cannot be used in consumer goods sector as compared to the capital goods sector. This leads to fall in prices of factors and resources become unemployed. Thus, with the continuous reduction in the prices of goods and factors in the economy, a long period of depression and unemployment begins. According to Hayek, when the fall in prices comes to an end during depression, banks begin to raise the supply of money, which reduces the market interest rate below the natural interest rate. This encourages investment and the process of revival begins in the economy. Its criticisms. The monetary overinvestment theory of Hayek has been criticized on the following counts. 1. Narrow assumption of full employment. This theory is based on the assumption of full employment, according to which capital goods are produced by reducing consumer goods. In reality, there is no full employment of resources. If resources remain unutilized, the expansion of both the capital goods sector and consumer goods sector may occur simultaneously. In such a situation, there is no need of transferring resources from one sector to the other. 2. Unrealistic assumption of equilibrium. The assumption of this theory that in the beginning savings and investment are in equilibrium in the economy and the banking system destroys this equilibrium is unrealistic. This is because the equilibrium may deviate due to both internal and external reasons. Page 339. 3. Interest rate not the only determinant. Hayek assumes changes in the rate of interest as the cause of fluctuations in the economy. This is not correct because besides changes in the rate of interest, the expectations of profit, innovation, invention, etc. also affect trade cycles. 4. Undue importance to forced savings. Professor Strigel has criticized this theory for giving undue importance to forced savings. According to him, when people with fixed incomes reduce their consumption with the increase in prices and the high income groups also reduce their consumption to the same extent, savings will not be forced but voluntary. 5. Investment does not fall with increase in consumer goods. Hayek argues that with the production of consumer goods and the increase in profits from them, investment falls in capital goods. This is not correct. According to Keynes, the marginal productivity of capital increases with the increase in profits of consumer goods. As a result, investment in capital goods also increases and does not fall. 6. Incomplete theory. Hayek's theory is incomplete because it does not explain the various phases of trade cycle. 3. Schumpeter's innovations theory. The innovations theory of trade cycles is associated with the name of Joseph Schumpeter. Note 7. J. A. Schumpeter, Business Cycles, 1939. According to Schumpeter, innovations in the structure of an economy are the source of economic fluctuations. Trade cycles are the outcome of economic development in a capitalist society. Schumpeter accepts Juglar's statement that the cause of depression is prosperity, and then gives his own view about the originating cause of the cycle. Schumpeter's approach involves the development of his model into two stages. The first stage deals with the initial impact of innovation, and the second stage follows through reactions to the original impact of innovation. The first approximation starts with the economic system in equilibrium, with every factor fully employed. Every firm is in equilibrium and producing efficiently, with its costs equal to its receipts. Product prices are equal to both average and marginal costs. Profits and interest rates are zero. There are no savings and investments. This equilibrium is characterized by Schumpeter as the circular flow, which continues to repeat itself in the same manner year after year, similar to the circulation of the blood in an animal organism. In circular flow, the same products are produced every year in the same manner. Schumpeter's theory starts with the breaking up of the circular flow by an innovation in the form of a new product by an entrepreneur for earning profit. By innovation, Schumpeter means such changes in the production of goods as cannot be affected by infinitesimal steps or variations of the margin. An innovation may consist of 1. The introduction of a new product. 2. The introduction of a new method of production. 3. The opening up of a new market. 4. The conquest of a new source of raw materials or semi-manufactured goods. And 5. The carrying out of the new organizations of an industry. Innovations are not inventions. According to Schumpeter, there is nothing that can explain that inventions occur in a cyclical manner. It is the introduction of a new product and the continual improvements in the existing ones that are the principal causes of business cycles. Schumpeter assigns the role of an innovator not to the capitalist but to an entrepreneur. The entrepreneur is not a man of ordinary ability but one who introduces something entirely new. He does not provide funds but directs their use. To perform his economic function, the entrepreneur requires two things. First, the existence of technical knowledge in order to produce new products, and second, the power of disposal over the factors of production in the form of bank credit. According to Schumpeter, a reservoir of untapped technical knowledge exists in a capitalist society which he can make use of. However, credit is essential for breaking the circular flow. The innovating entrepreneur is financed by expansion of bank credit. Since investment in an innovation is risky, he must pay interest on it. With his newly acquired funds, the innovator starts bidding away resources from other industries. Money incomes increase, prices begin to rise, thereby stimulating further investment. The new innovation starts producing goods, and there is an increased flow of goods in the economy. Consequently, supply exceeds demand. Prices and cost of production of goods start declining until recession sets in. Because of the low prices of goods, producers are not willing to expand production. During this period of recession, credit, prices, and interest rate decline, but total output is likely to average larger than in the preceding prosperity. Page 340. Thus, Schumpeter's first approximation consists of a two-phase cycle. The economy starts at the equilibrium state, rises to a peak, and then starts downwards into a recession, and continues till the new equilibrium is reached. This new equilibrium will be at a higher level of income than the initial equilibrium. because of the innovation which started the cycle. This is shown as the primary wave in figure 2. So in figure 2 we have time on the x-axis and income on the y-axis. So there is one half wave about the equilibrium path. Like in the earlier diagram, there is an equilibrium path which is a straight line at a very small angle inclined to the x-axis. So we have one half wave where it rises and then reaches the equilibrium as it falls down. This they have named as the primary wave. There is a secondary wave which is also rises from the same point as the first wave, and but it is a full complete wave. It rises, reaches a peak, then falls down through recession, reaches the trough, and then again on the revival path goes up. So this is figure 2. Returning to the text, the second approximation of Schumpeter follows through the reaction of the impact of the original innovation. Once the original innovation becomes successful and profitable, other entrepreneurs follow it in swarm-like clusters. Innovation in one field induces innovations in related fields. Consequently, money incomes and prices rise and help to create a cumulative expansion throughout the economy. With the increase in the purchasing power of consumers, the demand for the products of old industries increases in relation to supply. Prices rise further, profits increase, and old industries expand by borrowing from the banks. It induces a secondary wave of credit inflation, which is superimposed on the primary wave of innovation. Over-optimism and speculation add further to the boom. After a period of gestation, the new products start appearing in the market, displacing the old products and enforcing a process of liquidation, readjustment and absorption. The demand for the old products is decreased. Their prices fall. The old firms contract output and some are even forced to run into liquidation. As the innovators start repaying back loans out of profits, the quantity of money is decreased and prices tend to fall. Profits decline, uncertainty and risk increase. The impulse for innovation is reduced and eventually comes to an end. Depression sets in, and the painful process of readjustment to the point of previous neighborhood of equilibrium begins. Ultimately, the natural forces of recovery bring about a revival. Schumpeter believes in the existence of quantitative long wave of upswings and downswings in economic activity. Each long wave upswing is brought about by an innovation which leads to abundance of goods for the masses. Once the upswing ends, the long wave downswing begins. Thus, the second approximation of Schumpeter's theory of trade cycle develops into a four-phase cycle, with the recession, which was the second phase in the first approximation, continuing downward to give the depression phase. This extension of the cycle is followed by a period of revival which continues till the equilibrium level is reached. This is shown as the secondary wave in figure 2. Its criticisms. Schumpeter's treatment of the different phases and turning points of the cycle is novel and different from all other economists, but it is not free from certain criticisms. 1. Innovator not necessary for innovations. Schumpeter's analysis is based on the innovator. Such persons were to be found in the 18th and the 19th centuries who made innovations. But now all innovations form part of the functions of joint stock companies. Innovations are regarded as the routine of industrial concerns and do not require an innovator as such. 2. Innovations not the only cause of cycles. Schumpeter's contention that cyclical fluctuations are due to innovations is not correct. As a matter of fact, trade cycles may be due to psychological, manual, or financial causes. 3. Bank credit not the only source of funds. Schumpeter gives too much importance to bank credit in his theory. Bank credit may be important in the short run when industrial concerns get credit facilities from banks. Page 341. But in the long run, when the need for capital funds is much greater, bank credit is insufficient. For this, business houses have to float fresh shares and debentures in the capital market. Schumpeter's theory is weak in that it does not take these factors into consideration. 4. Innovation financed through voluntary savings does not produce a cycle. Critics point out that if an innovation is financed through voluntary savings or internal funds, there will not be an inflationary rise in prices. Consequently, in an underemployed economy, an innovation financed through voluntary savings might not generate a cycle. 5. Full employment assumption unrealistic. Schumpeter's analysis is based on the unrealistic assumption of full employment of resources to begin with. But the fact is that at the time of revival, the resources are unemployed. Thus, the introduction of an innovation may not lead to the withdrawal of labor and other resources from old industries. Thus, the competitive impact of an innovation would not increase costs and prices. Since full employment is an exception rather than the rule, thus, Schumpeter's theory is not a correct explanation of trade cycles. 4. The psychological theory. The psychological theory of business cycles has been mainly developed by Professor A. C. Piggio. Note 8. A. C. Piggio, Industrial Fluctuations, 1929. This theory attempts to explain the phenomena of business cycles on the basis of changes in the psychology of industrialists and businessmen. The tendency of the business class is to react excessively to the changing conditions of the economy, but are mainly responsible for cyclical fluctuations. According to Piggio, expectations originate from some real factors such as good harvests, wars, natural calamities, industrial disputes, innovations, etc. But he attributes the causes of business cycle into two categories, A. Impulses and B. Conditions. Impulses refer to those causes which set a process in motion. Conditions are, on the other hand, vehicles through which the process passes and upon which the impulses act. These conditions are the decision-making centers which in turn shift the level of economic activities and bring necessary changes in their compositions. They include monetary institutions, market structures, trade unions, etc. Piggio divides impulses into two parts. 1. The expectations held by businessmen, and 2. The actual economic resources owned by them. The expectations depend upon the psychology of businessmen and on their control over resources. But expectations which correspond to actual changes in the economy and are realized, they do not generate cyclical fluctuations. According to Piggio, it is only when expectations are devoid of their realistic basis, there may be error in forecasting. Such type of expectations cause disturbances in the economy and result in waves of optimism and pessimism. Such errors in forecasting may be due to 1. The deviation of actual demand from anticipated demand on the part of consumers. 2. The continual and unpredictable change in the values of economic variables. And 3. The existence of time lags on account of gestation periods. Once an error of forecasting occurs in any sector of the economy, it spreads in the same directions. Once this impulse starts acting on the conditions, it feeds upon itself. According to Piggio, this is because there is a certain measure of psychological interdependence. In other words, the expectations of optimism or pessimism on the part of businessmen strengthen the building up of further expectations of the same type. When businessmen have a feeling of optimism about the future prospects of business, it would increase the demand for investment resources, and inter-industry relations would induce businessmen in other industries to be optimist. Consequently, there is the emergence of boom conditions in the economy. Piggio opines that the wave of optimism is replaced by pessimism on account of time lags in production. Being over-pessimistic, some producers make the mistakes of over-investing in goods. When the goods start coming into the market in large quantities, it is not possible to sell them at remunerative prices. As a result, inventories accumulate. A wave of pessimism starts, which spreads to other sectors of the economy. This leads to the emergence of slump in the country. To Piggio, the lower turning point starts when inventories are depleted and the bolder spirit of industry helps to revive expectations. As a result, the rays of optimism slowly spread and revival starts, which leads to boom and so on. Thus, according to this theory, booms and slumps are due to alternative waves of optimism and pessimism on the part of businessmen and industrialists. Page 342. Its criticisms. The psychologic theory has been criticized for the following reasons. 1. This is not a theory of business cycles in the true sense because it fails to explain different phases of a business cycle. 2. It fails to explain the periodicity of a business cycle. 3. It neglects the role of various exogenous and monetary factors which influence business expectations. 4. The theory does not explain fully the causes that give rise to waves of optimism and pessimism in the business world. 5. The theory fails to explain the reason for deficiency of demand when goods start entering the market in larger quantities. Moreover, it does not explain as to why the deficiency of demand overtakes the flow of goods in the market. 5. The cobweb theory. The cobweb theory of business cycles was propounded in 1930 independently by Professors H. Schultz of America, J. Tinbergen of the Netherlands, and U. Ricci of Italy. But it was Professor N. Calder of Cambridge University, England, who used the name cobweb theory because the pattern of the movements of prices and outputs resembled a cobweb. The cobweb model is used to explain the dynamics of demand, supply, and price over long periods of time. There are many perishable agricultural commodities whose prices and outputs are determined over long periods and they show cyclical movements. As prices move up and down in cycles, quantities produced also seem to move up and down in a counter-cyclical manner. Such cycles in commodity prices and outputs are explained in terms of the cobweb model, so called because the diagrams look like cobwebs. Suppose the production process spreads over two periods, current and previous. Production in the current period is assumed to be determined by decisions made in the previous period. Thus, the current output reflects a production decision made by the producer during the previous period. This decision is in response to the price that he expects to rule during the current period when the crop is available for sale. But he expects that the price that would be established during the current period would equal the price during the previous period. The cobweb theory analyzes the movements of prices and outputs when supply is wholly determined by prices in the previous period. In order to find out the conditions for converging, diverging, or constant cycles, one has to first look at the slope of the demand curve and then of the supply curve. If the slope of the demand curve is numerically smaller than the slope of the supply curve, the prices will converge towards equilibrium. Conversely, if the slope of the demand curve is numerically greater than the slope of the supply curve, the price will diverge from equilibrium. If the slope of the demand curve is numerically the same as that of the supply curve, the price will oscillate around this equilibrium value. Its assumptions. The cobweb theory is based on the following assumptions. 1. The current year's, that is T, small t, supply depends upon the last or the previous year's, that is T minus 1, decisions regarding output level. Hence, current output is influenced by last year's price, that is P is a function of T minus 1. 2. The current period or year is divided into sub-periods of a week or fortnight. 3. The parameters determining the supply function have constant values over a series of periods. 4. Current demand DT for the commodity is a function of the current price PT. 5. The price expected to rule in the current period is the actual price in the last year. 6. The commodity under consideration is perishable and can be stored only for 1 year. 7. Both supply and demand functions are linear. The theory. There are three types of cobwebs. 1. Convergent. 2. Divergent. And 3. Continuous. They are explained as under. 1. Convergent cobweb. Under this formulation of the cobweb theorem, the supply function is ST, which is equal to S within bracket T minus 1, and the demand function is DT, which is equal to D into bracket PT. The market equilibrium will be when the quantity supplied equals the quantity demanded, that is ST is equal to DT. In any market in which producer's current supply is in response to the price during the last year, equilibrium can be established only through a series of adjustments that take place over several consecutive periods. Page 343. Let us take potato growers who produce only one crop a year. They decide about how many potatoes they will grow this year on the assumption that the price of potatoes this year will equal the price in the last year. The market demand and supply curves for potatoes are represented by D and S curves respectively in figure 3. Figure 3 is a complicated figure, so I will not be able to explain it to you. You will have to refer to the digitized version. The price in the last year was OP and the producers decide the equilibrium output OQ this year. But the potato crop is damaged due to a blight so that their current output is OQ1, which is smaller than the equilibrium output OQ. This leads to the rise in the price to OP1 in the current period. In the next period, the potato growers will produce OQ2 quantity in response to the higher price OP1, which is equal to Q1B. But this is more than the equilibrium quantity OQ which is needed in the market. It will therefore lower the price to OP2, which is equal to Q2D, and thus again lead to changes in the production plans of producers, whereby they will reduce supply to OQ3 in the third period. But this quantity is less than the equilibrium quantity OQ. Price will therefore rise to OP3, which is equal to Q3F, which in turn will encourage producers to produce OQ quantity. Ultimately, the equilibrium will be established at point small g, where D and S curves intersect. The series of adjustments just described trace out a cobweb pattern small a, b, c, d, e and f, which converge towards the point of market equilibrium G when period-to-period changes in price and quantity have been reduced to zero. The cobweb is convergent. 2. Divergent cobweb. But there may be an unstable cobweb when price and quantity changes move away from the equilibrium position. This is illustrated in figure 4. Again, I will not be able to explain this figure. Suppose from the initial price quantity equilibrium situation of OP and OQ, there is a temporary disturbance that causes output to fall to OQ1. This raises the price to OP1, which is equal to Q1 small a. The increased price in turn raises output to OQ2, which is more than the equilibrium output OQ. Consequently, the price falls to OP2. But at this price, the demand OQ2 exceeds the supply OQ3. As a result, price shoots up to OP3, that is Q3E, and the adjustment of producers to this price leads further away from the equilibrium. This is an explosive situation and the equilibrium position is unstable. The cobweb is divergent. 3. Continuous cobweb. The cobweb may be of constant amplitude with perpetually oscillating prices and quantities as shown in figure 5. So again, I will not explain this figure. Suppose that the price in the current year is OP. Thus, the quantity to be supplied is going to be OQ1. But in order to sell this output, the price that it will fetch in the next period will be OP1. But at this price, the demand OQ1 is more than supply OQ, which will again raise the price to OP, which is equal to QB. In this way, prices and quantities will move in a circle with oscillations of constant amplitude around the equilibrium point E. page 344. Its criticisms. The analysis of the cobweb theory is based upon very restrictive assumptions which make its applicability doubtful. 1. Non-realistic. It is non-realistic to assume that the demand and supply conditions remain unchanged over the previous and current periods, so that the demand and supply curves do not change or shift. In reality, they are bound to change with considerable divergences between the actual and the expected prices. Suppose the price is so low that some producers incur heavy losses. As a result, the number of sellers is reduced, which changes the position of the supply curve. It is also possible that the expected price may be quite different from the estimated price. As a result, the cobweb may not develop properly on the basis of unchanged demand and supply curves. Thus, demand, supply, and price relations that lead to different cobwebs have little real applicability. 2. Output not determined by price. The theory assumes that the output is determined by the price only. In reality, the agricultural output in particular is determined by several other factors also, such as weather, seeds, fertilizer, technology, etc. 3. Divergent cobweb impossible. Critics hold that divergent cobweb is impossible. It is obvious from figure 4 that once the equilibrium is upset, the cobweb cycle goes on diverging for an infinite period, which leads to an explosive situation. This is impossible. 4. Continuous cobweb impractical. Critics point out that continuous cobweb is impractical because it cannot continue indefinitely. This is because producers incur more loss than profit from it. This is explained by figure 5. If a farmer produces OQ output, he receives total revenue OQBP, whereas his total cost is OQAP1 and his net profit is PBAP1. When the output is OQ1, total revenue is OQ1DP1, while the total cost is OQ1CP. Thus, he incurs P1DCP total loss. Hence, in the case of continuous cobweb cycle, the producers have to face alternative years of profit and loss. But losses always exceed profit. Therefore, this cycle is impractical. 5. Not a theory. In reality, cobweb is not a business cycle theory because it only explains fluctuations in the agricultural sector. So, it is not used in explaining business cycles. Implications. The cobweb model is an oversimplification of the real price determination process, but it supplies new information to the market participants about market behavior which they can incorporate in their decisions. The cobweb model is not merely an adjustment process of the market equilibrium, but it also predicts unobservable events. Its significance lies in the demand, supply, and price behavior of agricultural commodities. Expectations about future conditions have an important influence on current prices. If there are boom conditions in the country, the farmers expect higher prices of their crops and increase their supplies in the market. But in the event of crop failures, the supplies of agricultural commodities will be reduced. In such a situation, the government may exempt farmers from agricultural taxes and even provide interest-free loans to tide over the crisis. On the contrary, a bumper crop may lower the prices of agricultural crops by increasing their supplies more than their demand. In such a situation, the government may give subsidies to farmers or procure agricultural products at minimum support prices from the farmers. 6. Keynes's theory. The Keynesian theory of the trade cycle is an integral part of his theory of income, output, and employment. Trade cycles are periodic fluctuations of income, output, and employment. Keynes regards the trade cycle as mainly due to a cyclical change in the marginal efficiency of capital, though complicated and often aggravated by associated changes in the other significant short period variables of the economic system. Page 345. According to Keynes, the principal cause of depression and unemployment is the lack of aggregate demand. Revival can be brought about by raising aggregate demand, which in turn can be raised by increasing consumption and/or investment. Since consumption is stable during the short run, revival is possible by increasing investment. Similarly, the main cause of the downturn is reduction in investment. Thus, in the Keynesian explanation of the trade cycle, the cycle consists primarily of fluctuations in the rate of investment, and fluctuations in the rate of investment are caused mainly by fluctuations in the marginal efficiency of capital. The MEC, that is marginal efficiency of capital, depends on the supply price of capital assets and their prospective yield. Since the supply price of capital assets is stable in the short run, the MEC is determined by prospective yield of capital assets, which in turn depends on business expectations. Fluctuations in the rate of investment are also caused by fluctuations in the rate of interest. But Keynes gives more importance to fluctuations in the MEC as the principal cause of cyclical fluctuations. To explain the course of the Keynesian cycle, we start with the expansion phase. During the expansion phase, the MEC is high. Businessmen are optimistic. There is rapid increase in the rate of investment. Consequently, output, employment, and income increase. Every increase in investment leads to a multiple increase in income via the multiplier effect. This cumulative process of rising investment, income, and employment continues till the boom is reached. As the boom progresses, there is a tendency for the MEC to fall due to two reasons. First, as more capital goods are being produced steadily, the current yield on them declines. Second, at the same time, the current costs of new capital goods rise due to shortages and bottlenecks of materials and labor. During the downturn, investment falls due to a fall in the MEC and rise in the rate of interest. This leads to a cumulative decline in employment and income via the reverse operation of the multiplier. Further, the fall in the MEC may shift the consumption function downward, thereby hastening the depression. Keynes attaches more importance to the sudden collapse of MEC than to a rise in the rate of interest as an explanation of the downturn of the cycle leading to the crisis and the depression. Unlike the sudden collapse of the economic system, the revival takes time. It depends on factors which bring about the recovery of the MEC. The time which must elapse before recovery begins depends partly upon the magnitude of the normal rate of growth of the economy and partly upon the length of life of capital goods. The shorter the length of life of durable assets, the shorter the depression. And also, the more rapid the rate of growth, the shorter the depression. Another factor which governs the duration of depression is the carrying costs of surplus stocks. According to Keynes, the carrying cost of surplus stocks during the depression is seldom less than 10% per annum. So for a few years, disinvestment in stocks will continue till the surplus stocks are exhausted. Optimism takes the place of pessimism. The MEC increases. Fresh investment starts taking place. Revival has started. Its criticisms. Keynes' theory of the trade cycle is superior to the earlier theories because it is more than a theory of the business cycle in the sense that it offers a general explanation of the level of employment, quite independently of the cyclical nature of changes in employment. However, critics are not lacking in pointing out its weaknesses. 1. Overemphasis on the role of expectations. Keynes has been criticized for his analysis of business cycle based on expectations. In fact, he overemphasized the role of expectations in influencing the MEC. According to Hart, Keynes relied on the convention of forecasting changes in business expectations. The reliance on the conventional hypothesis makes Keynes' concept of expectations superfluous and unrealistic. 2. Psychological theory. Keynes considers the trade cycle as mainly due to fluctuations in the MEC. The MEC in turn determines the rate of investment, and investment decisions depend upon the psychology of businessmen or producers. Thus, Keynes's theory is not much different from Piaget's psychological theory of the trade cycle. 3. Explanation of crisis wrong. Keynes attributes the downturn to the sudden collapse in the MEC. According to Hazlitt, The term MEC being vague and ambiguous, Keynes's explanation of the crisis of the marginal efficiency of capital is either a useless truism or an obvious error. 4. Incomplete theory. Another weakness of Keynes's theory of the trade cycle is that some of its variables, such as expectations, MEC, and investment, cannot explain the different phases of the cycle. In the words of Dillard, it is less than a complete theory of business cycle because it makes no attempt to give a detailed account of the various phases of the cycle. Page 346. 5. Not based on empirical data. Saulnier criticizes Keynes for lacking in factual proof. According to him, Keynes makes no attempt to test any of his deductions with facts. Dillard also points towards this defect when he writes that Keynes does not examine closely the empirical data of cyclical fluctuations. 6. One-sided theory. One of the serious omissions of Keynes's theory of the trade cycle is the acceleration principle. This made his theory one-sided because his explanation centers around the principle of multiplier. As pointed out by Sir John Hicks, the theory of acceleration and the theory of multiplier are two sides of the theory of fluctuations, just as the theory of demand and the theory of supply are the two sides of the theory of value. 7. Samuelson's model of business cycle. Professor Samuelson, note 9. Paul A. Samuelson, Interactions Between the Multiplier Analysis and Principles of Acceleration, RES, May 1939. Professor Samuelson constructed a multiplier accelerator model assuming one period lag and different values for the MPC, alpha, and the accelerator, beta, that result in changes in the level of income pertaining to five different types of fluctuations. The Samuelson model is YT is equal to GT plus CT plus IT, where YT is the national income Y at time T, which is the sum of the government expenditure GT, consumption expenditure CT, and induced investment IT. That was equation 1. CT is equal to alpha times YT minus 1. This is equation 2. Here, consumption in period T is regarded as a function of the previous period T minus 1. IT is equal to beta into CT minus CT minus 1. This is equation 3. Substituting equation 2 in 3, we have IT is equal to beta into alpha YT minus 1 minus alpha YT minus 2, or IT is equal to alpha into beta into YT minus 1 minus alpha into beta into T minus 2. This is equation 4. GT is equal to 1. Substituting 2, 4 and 5 in equation 1, we have YT is equal to 1 plus alpha YT minus 1 plus beta into alpha YT minus 1 minus beta into alpha YT minus 2. Equation 6, which is equal to 1 plus alpha into within bracket YT minus 1 plus beta YT minus 1 end of bracket minus beta alpha YT minus 2, which is equal to 1 plus alpha into within bracket 1 plus beta end of bracket into YT minus 1 minus beta alpha YT minus 2. This is equation 7. According to Samuelson, if we know the national income for two periods, the national income for the following period can be simply derived by taking a weighted sum. The weights depend, of course, upon the values chosen for the marginal propensity to consume and for the relation, that is, accelerator. Depending the value of the marginal propensity to consume to be greater than 0 and less than 1, that is, 0 is less than alpha is less than 1, and of the accelerator greater than 0, that is, beta is greater than 0, Samuelson explains five types of cyclical fluctuations, which are summarized in Table 1. So, in Table 1, we have Samuelson's interaction model. There are three columns. First column is the case number, second is values, and the third is behavior of the cycle. So for first, when alpha is 0.5, beta is 0, then it is cycle-less path. Second, alpha is equal to 0.5, beta is equal to 1. It is damped fluctuations. 3, alpha is equal to 0.5, beta is equal to 2. Fluctuations of constant amplitude. 4, alpha is equal to 0.5, beta is equal to 3. Explosive cycles. And finally, case 5, when alpha is equal to 0.5 and beta is equal to 4, cycle-less explosive path. Case 1. Samuelson's case 1 shows a cycle-less path because it is based on the multiplier effect, the accelerator playing no part in it. This is shown in figure 6A. So in figure 6, there are 5 panels A, B, C, D, and E, but they are like curves which are difficult to explain. So I am not going to explain the figure. Case 2 shows a damped cyclical path fluctuating around the static multiplier level and gradually subsiding to that level. This is shown in figure 6B. Case 3 depicts cycles of constant amplitude repeating themselves around the multiplier level. This case is depicted in figure 6C. Page 347. Case 4 reveals anti-damped or explosive cycles as in figure 6D. Case 5 relates to a cycle-less explosive upward path eventually approaching a compound interest rate of growth as shown in figure 6E. Of the 5 cases explained above, only 3 cases, 2, 3 and 4 are cyclical in nature. But they can be reduced to 2 because case 3 pertaining to cycles of constant amplitude has not been experienced. So as far as case 2 of damped cycles is concerned, these cycles have been occurring irregularly in a milder form over the last half century. Generally, cycles in the post-World War II period have been relatively damped compared to those in the inter-World War II period. They are the result of such disturbances, which may be called erratic shocks, arising from exogenous factors such as wars, changes in crops, inventions, and so on, which might be expected to come along with fair persistence, but it is not possible to measure their magnitude. Case 4 of the explosive cycles has not been found in the past, its absence being the result of endogenous economic factors that limit the swings. Hicks has, however, built a model of trade cycle assuming values that would make for explosive cycles kept in check by ceilings and floors. Critical appraisal of the model. The interaction of the multiplier and the accelerator has the merit of raising national income at a much faster rate than by either the multiplier or the accelerator alone. It serves as a useful tool not only for explaining business cycles but also as a guide to stabilization policy. As pointed out by Professor Kurihara, it is in conjunction with the multiplier analysis based on the concept of marginal propensity to consume being less than 1 that the acceleration principle serves as a useful tool of business cycle analysis and a helpful guide to business cycle policy. The multiplier and the accelerator combined together produce cyclical fluctuations. The greater the value of the accelerator beta, the greater is the chance of an explosive cycle. The greater the value of the multiplier, the greater the chance of a cycle-less path. Limitations. Despite these apparent uses of the multiplier-accelerator interaction, this analysis has its limitations. 1. Samuelson is silent about the length of the period in different cycles explained by him. 2. This model assumes that the marginal propensity to consume alpha and the accelerator beta are constant, but in reality they change with the level of income so that this is applicable only to the study of small fluctuations. 3. The cycles explained in this model oscillate about a stationary level in a trendless economy. This is not realistic because an economy is not trendless, but it is in a process of growth. This has led Hicks to formulate his theory of the trade cycle in a growing economy. 4. According to Duzenberry, it presents a mechanical explanation of the trade cycle because it is based on the multiplier-accelerator interaction in rigid form. 5, it ignores the effects of monetary changes upon business cycles. 8. Hicks's theory of business cycle. J.R. Hicks, in his book A Contribution to the Theory of the Trade Cycle, builds his theory of business cycle around the principle of multiplier-accelerator interaction. To him, the theory of the acceleration and the theory of the multiplier are two sides of the theory of fluctuations. Unlike Samuelson's model, it is concerned with the problem of growth and of a moving equilibrium. Page 348. Ingredients of the theory. The ingredients of Hicks's theory of trade cycle are warranted rate of growth, consumption function, autonomous investment, and induced investment function, and multiplier accelerator relation. The warranted rate of growth is the rate which will sustain itself. It is consistent with saving investment equilibrium. The economy is said to be growing at the warranted rate when real investment and real saving are taking place at the same time. According to Hicks, it is a multiplier accelerator interaction which weaves the path of economic fluctuations around the warranted growth rate. The consumption function takes the form Ct is equal to alpha y t minus 1. Consumption in period t is regarded as a function of the income y of the previous period t minus 1. Thus, consumption lags behind income and the multiplier is treated as a lagged relation. The autonomous investment is independent of changes in the level of output. Hence, it is not related to the growth of the economy. The induced investment, on the other hand, is dependent on changes in the level of output. Hence, it is a function of the growth or rate of the economy. In the Hicksian theory, the accelerator is based on induced investment, which along with the multiplier brings out an upturn. The accelerator is defined by Hicks as the ratio of induced investment to the increase in income. Given constant values of the multiplier and the accelerator, it is the leverage effect that is responsible for economic fluctuations. Assumptions of the theory. The Hicksian theory of trade cycle is based on the following assumptions. 1. Hicks assumes a progressive economy in which autonomous investment increases at a constant rate so that the system remains in a moving equilibrium. The saving and investment coefficients are disturbed over time in such a way that an upward displacement from equilibrium path leads to a lagged movement away from equilibrium. 3. Hicks assumes constant values for the multiplier and the accelerator. 4. The economy cannot expand beyond the full employment of level of output. Thus, the full employment ceiling acts as a direct restraint on the upward expansion of the economy. 5. The working of the accelerator in the downswing provides an indirect restraint on the downward movement of the economy. The rate of decrease in the accelerator is limited by the rate of depreciation in the downswing. 6. The relation between the multiplier and accelerator is treated in a lagged manner, since consumption and induced investment are assumed to operate with a time lag. 7. It is assumed that the average capital output ratio V is greater than unity and that gross investment does not fall below zero. Thus, the cycles are inherently explosive but are contained by ceilings and floors of the economy. The Hicksian theory. Hicks explains his theory of the trade cycle in terms of figure 7. So in figure 7, we have time on the x-axis and output and investment on the y-axis. There are four lines. One is equilibrium line EE, which is a straight line with a rising curve with a small angle to the x-axis. Then there is a curve, a wave curve, starting at point P0 on E. It rises and reaches up to P1. Then there is, it is flat for a very small time, so between P1 and P2 is flat. Then it starts falling down, that is the falling curve, which is P3. It goes up to Q2. Q1 is the point where it intersects E. Then it goes to Q2, and at Q3 it starts rising again. So the point P1, P2, if it is connected, you have an FF line which is parallel to E. And if you connect Q2, Q3, we have an LL line which is parallel to E. And there is a line below L, that is AA line. There is another point Q. So between Q1, Q, there is a sharp fall in the curve, which is a dotted curve. Going back to the text. Line AA shows the path of autonomous investment growing at a constant rate. EE is the equilibrium level of output which depends on AA and is deducted from it by the application of the multiplier accelerator interaction to it. Line FF is the full employment ceiling level above the equilibrium path EE and is growing at the constant rate of autonomous investment. LL is the lower equilibrium path of output representing the floor or the sump equilibrium line. Hicks begins from a cycleless position P0 on the equilibrium path EE when an increase in the rate of autonomous investment leads to an upward movement in income. As a result, the growth of output and income propelled by the combined operation of the multiplier and accelerator moves the economy on to the upward expansion path from P0 to P1. According to Hicks, this upward swing phase relates to the standard cycle, which will lead to an explosive situation because of the given values of the multiplier and the accelerator. But this does not happen because of the upper limit or ceiling set by the full employment level FF. Hicks writes in this connection, "I shall follow Keynes in assuming that there is some point at which output becomes inelastic in response to an increase in effective demand. Thus, certain bottlenecks of supply emerge which prevent output from reaching the peak and instead encounter the ceiling at P1. Page 349. When the economy hits the full employment ceiling at P1, it will creep along the ceiling for a period of time to P2, and the downward swing will not start immediately. The economy will move along the ceiling from P1 to P2 depending upon the time period of the investment lag. The greater the investment lag, the more economy will move along the ceiling path. Since income at this level is decreasing relative to the previous stage of the cycle, there is a decreased amount of investment. This much of investment is insufficient to keep the economy at the ceiling level, and then the downturn starts. During the downswing, the multiplier accelerator mechanism sets in reverse, falling investment, reducing income, reduced income, reducing investment, and so on progressively. If the accelerator worked continuously, output would plunge downward below the equilibrium level EE. And because of explosive tendencies to a greater extent than it rose above it. The fall in output in this case might be a steep one, as shown by P2, P3, Q. But in the downswing, the accelerator does not work so swiftly as in the upswing. If the slump is severe, induced investment will quickly fall to zero and the value of the accelerator becomes zero. The rate of decrease in investment is limited by the rate of depreciation. Thus, the total amount of investment in the economy is equal to the autonomous investment minus the constant rate of depreciation. Since autonomous investment is taking place, the fall in output is much gradual and the slump much longer than the boom as indicated by Q1, Q2. At Q2, the slump reaches the bottom or the floor provided by the LL line. The economy does not turn upward immediately from Q2, but will move along the slump equilibrium line to Q3 because of the existence of excess capacity in the economy. Finally, when all excess capacity is exhausted, autonomous investment will cause income to rise, which will in turn lead to an increase in induced investment, so that the accelerator is triggered off, which, along with the multiplier, moves the economy towards the ceiling again. It is in this way that the cyclical process will be repeated in the economy. Its criticisms. The Hicksian theory of the business cycle has been severely criticized by Duesenberry, Smithies, and others on the following grounds. 1. Value of multiplier not constant. Hicks's model assumes that the value of the multiplier remains constant during the different phases of the trade cycle. This is based on the Keynesian stable consumption function. But this is not a realistic assumption, as Friedman has proved on the basis of empirical evidence that the marginal propensity to consume does not remain stable in relation to cyclical changes in income. Thus, the value of the multiplier changes with different phases of the cycle. 2. Value of accelerator not constant. Hicks has also been criticized for assuming a constant value of the accelerator during the different phases of the cycle. The constancy of the accelerator presupposes a constant capital output ratio. These are unrealistic assumptions because the capital output ratio is itself subject to change due to technological factors, the nature and composition of investment, the gestation period of capital goods, etc. Lundberg therefore suggests that the assumption of constancy in accelerator should be abandoned for a realistic approach to the understanding of trade cycles. 3. Autonomous investment not continuous. Hicks assumes that autonomous investment continues throughout the different phases of the cycle at a steady pace. This is unrealistic because financial crisis in a slump may reduce autonomous investment below its normal level. Further, it is also possible, as pointed out by Schumpeter, that autonomous investment may itself be subject to fluctuations due to a technological innovation. 4. Growth not dependent only on changes in autonomous investment. Another weakness of the Hicksian model is that growth is made dependent upon changes in autonomous investment. It is a burst of autonomous investment from the equilibrium path that leads to growth. According to Professor Smithies, the source of growth should lie within the system. Note 12, A. Smithies, Economic Fluctuations and Growth, Econometrica, January 1957. In imputing growth to an unexplained extraneous factor, Hicks has failed to provide a complete explanation of the cycle. Page 350. 5. Distinction between autonomous and induced investment not feasible. Critics like Duzenberry, note 13, J. B. Duzenberry, Business Cycles and Economic Growth, 1958, and Lundberg, note E. Lundberg, The Stability Growth, JEP, number 8, 1958, point out that Hicks's distinction between autonomous and induced investment is not feasible in practice. As pointed out by Lundberg, every investment is autonomous in the short run and a major amount of autonomous investment becomes induced in the long run. It is also possible that a part of a particular investment may be autonomous and a part induced, as in the case of machinery. Hence, this distinction between autonomous and induced investment is of doubtful validity in practice. 6. Ceiling fails to explain adequately the onset of depression. Hicks has been criticized for his explanation of the ceiling or the upper limit of the cycle. According to Duzenberry, the ceiling fails to explain adequately the onset of depression. It may at best check growth and not cause a depression. Shortage of resources cannot bring a sudden decline in investment and thus cause a depression. The recession of 1953-54 in America was not caused by shortage of resources. Further, as admitted by Hicks himself, depression may start even before reaching the full employment ceiling due to monetary factors. 7. Explanation of floor and lower turning point not convincing. Hicks's explanation of the floor and the lower turning point is not convincing. According to Hicks, it is autonomous investment that brings a gradual movement towards the floor, and it is again increase in autonomous investment at the bottom that leads to the lower turning point. Harrod doubts the contention that autonomous investment would be increasing at the bottom of the depression. Depression may retard rather than encourage autonomous investment. Further, Hicks's contention that revival would start with the exhaustion of excess capacity has not been proved by empirical evidence. Rending's Fell's study of the American business cycle in the 19th century has revealed that the revival was not due to exhaustion of excess capacity. Rather, in certain cases, revival started even when there was excess capacity. 8. full employment level, not independent of output path. Another criticism leveled against Hicks's model is that the full employment ceiling, as defined by Hicks, it is independent of the path of output. According to Dernberg and McDougall, the full employment level depends on the magnitude of the resources that are available to the country. The capital stock is one of the resources. When the capital stock is increasing during any period, the ceiling is raised. Since the rate at which output increases determines the rate at which capital stock changes, the ceiling level of output will differ depending on the time path of output. 9. Explosive cycle not realistic. Hicks assumes in his model that the average capital output ratio V is greater than unity for a time lag of 1 year or less. Thus, explosive cycles are inherent in his model. But empirical evidence shows that the response of investment to a change in output V is spread over many periods. As a result, there have been damped cycles rather than explosive cycles. 10. Mechanical explanation of trade cycle. Another serious limitation of the theory is that it presents a mechanical explanation of the trade cycle. This is because the theory is based on the multiplier-accelerator interaction in rigid form, according to Calder and Dusenberry. Thus, it is a mechanical sort of explanation in which human judgment, business expectations, and decisions play little or no part. Investment plays a leading role based on formula rather than on judgment. 11. Contraction phase not longer than expansion phase. Hicks has been criticized by asserting that the contraction phase is longer than expansion phase of the trade cycle. But the actual behavior of the post-war cycle has shown that the expansionary phase of the business cycle is much longer than the contractionary phase. Conclusion. Despite these apparent weaknesses of the Hicksian model, it is superior to all the earlier theories in satisfactorily explaining the turning points of the business cycle. To conclude with Dernberg and McDougall, the Hicks model serves as a useful framework of analysis which, with modification, yields a fairly good picture of cyclical fluctuations within a framework of growth. It serves especially to emphasize that in a capitalist economy characterized by substantial amounts of durable equipment, a period of contraction inevitably follows expansion. Hicks's model also pinpoints the fact that in the absence of technical progress and other powerful growth factors, the economy will tend to languish in depression for long periods of time. The model is at best suggestive. Page 351. 9. Goodwin's trade cycle model. Goodwin, note 14, R. M. Goodwin, The Non-Linear Accelerator and the Persistence of Business Cycles, Econometrica, January 1951. Goodwin presents a non-linear model of trade cycle as against Hicks's linear model. Features of the model. The main features of Goodwin's model are A. A linear consumption function C is equal to alpha y plus C0, where alpha is equal to consumption income ratio, C0 is the autonomous consumption. B. Net investment I is equal to the rate of change in capital stock, which is the result of adjustment between actual capital K and desired capital K bar, and K bar is equal to beta y plus alpha, where beta is the accelerator. C. Desired capital K bar is proportional to output Y. D. Net investment changes due to a change in output, which in turn changes the level of desired capital. As a result, the accelerator, which is non-linear, brings a change in output via net investment. Goodwin shows three possibilities for net investment. 1. When K bar is greater than K, there will be increase in the rate of net investment, which will shift the economy to full capacity output for capital goods industries. 2. When K bar is equal to K, this situation is maintained by meeting the replacement demand and by keeping net investment as zero, that is I equal to zero. And 3. When K is greater than K bar, the adjustment takes place with the scrappage rate K2. Cyclical path. To explain the cyclical path of Goodwin's model, we start with k equal to k bar situation, where the equilibrium level of output y is equal to 1 upon 1 minus alpha, the whole multiplied by c0 plus I, and I is equal to a is the technological growth factor. These take the system along an equilibrium path. This path is similar to the Hicksian line EE. The Hicksian path relates to a steady increase in autonomous investment, while Goodwin's path relates to a rise in desired capital resulting from a continuous technical change. Any divergence from this equilibrium path will not bring the economy towards it, and there will be continuous fluctuations around it. Take k bar greater than k. The desired capital stock being more than the actual capital, investment increases and the propelling forces of multiplier and accelerator will push the system in the upward direction. During this phase of expansion, given the constant rate of depreciation, net investment increases in proportion to the change in output. As the accelerator of Goodwin's model is non-linear, the increase in net investment is not related to the increase in output, but to the difference between the actual capital stock K and the desired capital stock K bar. This difference is determined by the rate of change in output. This investment relationship being continuous, investment is immediately pushed to the extreme position. Thus, expansion reaches a situation where I is equal to dk by dt equal to k1, the rate of capital goods capacity output. This restricts the increase in output and the accelerator becomes discontinuous. During the expansion phase, k bar is greater than k, but at the peak, k is equal to k bar, which is due to a decline in the rate of autonomous investment. Page 352. Once the desired capital K bar exceeds the actual capital stock K, the desired capital K bar will be equal to the scrappage or replacement rate K2. This leads to a fall in the desired capital K bar and in the rate of autonomous investment. Thus, the contraction path of the system starts. During the contraction phase, when K is greater than K bar, gap between the two is to be met by the scrappage rate K2. Simultaneously, the desired capital K bar continues to rise by the technological growth factor. The gap between K and K bar is being closed by the gradual elimination of excess capacity through failure to replace and the steady occurrence of capital using innovations. In this way, the contraction path pushes the economic system to the lowest extreme point of I equal to minus K2. When the economy reaches the lower turning point of k equal to k bar, the level of desired capital k bar is to be raised. This is possible by stimulating the constant technical growth factor. When k bar is greater than k, the expansion again starts. So long as the technical progress continues, the economy cannot remain at the lower turning point. In fact, fast technical progress will expand the economy soon. As against the Hicksian model, the Goodwin's cycle does not creep along the floor or the ceiling level. Rather, it jumps from these levels. Both boom and recession bring contraction and recovery of their own. If the growth factor does not exist in technological change, there will be no autonomous investment in the capital stock. Consequently, the economy will remain stuck in the contraction phase for a long time instead of expanding, because it takes more time for capital to depreciate than in capital formation. In such a situation, there will be one-sided formation of trade cycles as shown in figure 8. Now, this is a very complicated figure, which is why I will not explain it. You will have to refer to the digitized version. In the beginning of the expansion phase, K bar increases to OA level and K also rises and equals it. When K equal to K bar, contraction or downswing starts. K bar is reduced to OB level and K also declines and equals K bar. There being no technological change in the growth factor, it takes more time for K to equal K bar. There are two features of the Goodwin cycle in figure 8. 1. In the expansion phase, K bar is greater than K, and in the contraction phase, K is greater than K bar. 2. At the peak of each cycle, the common level of k-bar is OA, which is smaller than the OB level of k-bar at the trough and shows more time for k to equal k-bar. This is clear from the dotted horizontal lines at OA level in the upper portion and the dotted horizontal lines at the OB level in the lower portion of figure 8. On the other hand, if the growth factor for technological progress is included, k-bar continues to increase with each cycle and it takes a long time for k to equal k-bar in the expansion phase. When the downswing starts, there being no growth factor, the contraction phase becomes shorter. Thus, the presence and absence of technological growth factor make the subsequent peaks and troughs at the higher level than the earlier peaks and troughs in the Goodwin cycle. These are shown as upper and lower dotted lines in figure 9. Again, figure 9 is a very complicated figure and I will not try to explain it to you. Page 353. In the figure, small AA line shows the technological growth factor, which is similar to the Hicksian EE line, where k is equal to k bar is equal to small a. The upper and the lower limits of k bar have been shown by dotted lines. P represent peaks and capital T as troughs, where k is equal to k bar. The contraction path PT becomes shorter than the expansion path TP. Its criticisms. The following are the weaknesses of Goodwin's model. 1. Unrealistic. The Goodwin model is unrealistic on two counts. First, it shows that the recessionary phase is longer than the expansionary phase of the cycle as shown in figure 9. Second, the desired stock of capital becomes constant at the peak as shown by dotted lines in figure 9. 2. Empirically wrong. The Goodwin model shows that when the economy reaches the peak and the trough, it at once takes a downturn and upturn respectively. This is empirically wrong because both recession and recovery are slow processes. As Hicks has also pointed out, that the economy creeps along the upper and the lower ceilings. Conclusion. Despite these limitations, according to Professor Allen, the advantage of Goodwin's model is that the non-linear element is built in. The resulting oscillation maintains itself without any dependence on outside factors or on particular initial or historical conditions. Note 15. R. G. D. Allen, Mathematical Economics, 1969. Differences between Goodwin and Hicks's models. Goodwin's model is different from Hicks's model on the following points. 1. The Hicksian model shows only how cycles take place, but Goodwin's model traces the time path of a realistic cycle. 2. The Hicks model is linear, which becomes non-linear when the ceiling and the floor of a cycle meet, but Goodwin's model is throughout non-linear. 3. Hicks combines growth and cycles in his model and keeps growth dependent on autonomous investment. According to Goodwin, growth depends on technological change, which continuously increases the productive capacity of the economy. 4. The equilibrium path EE of Hicks is based on continuous increase in autonomous investment. But Goodwin's growth path AA is based on the increase in desired capital K bar, which is the result of continuous technological changes. 10. Friedman's theory of business cycles. This theory is also known as money and business cycles theory. Friedman and Schwartz. Note 16. M. Friedman and A. W. Schwartz. Money and Business Cycles. RES Supplement, 1963. So Friedman and Schwartz have argued on the basis of US historical data that business cycles are mostly monetary in origin. It is the money stock itself that shows a consistent cyclical behavior, which is closely related to the cyclical movements in economic activity at large. About the causal relation between the money stock and economic activity, they make the following generalizations. 1. Changes in economic activity have always been accompanied by changes in the money stock. 2. There have not been major changes in the money stock that have not been accompanied by changes in economic activity, and 3, changes in the stock of money have been attributed to a specific variety of exogenous factors rather than to changes in economic activity. Page 354. Thus, changes in the money stock are a consequence as well as independent cause of changes in economic activity. But once they occur, they will in turn produce still further effects on economic activity. There is also much evidence that during business cycles, the money stock plays a largely an independent role. In one of his earlier writings, Friedman emphasizes that the concept of lag is related to the business cycle. These cycles are mostly monetary in origin. A monetary change affects different economic magnitudes, some of which adjust faster than others, which cause distortions in economic activity, thereby giving rise to the business cycles. Thus, it has to be said, in Fisher's words, that the cycle is largely a dance of the dollar. Major US historical economic fluctuations include inflationary and deep depression cycles. According to Friedman and Schwartz, the empirical evidence justifies the generalizations noted above. These show that the stock of money has displayed a systematic cyclical pattern over the decades. The money stock generally reaches its peak before the reference peak of the cycles. Similarly, it reaches its trough before the reference trough. One of their estimates of the lag between turning points in the growth of the money stock and in the level of economic activity reveals that during the 7 cycles between 1927 and 1970, peaks in the rate of change in the money stock precede reference cycle peaks in the economic activity series before downturns by 20 months on an average, and troughs in the rate of change of money stock precede reference troughs by about 11 months on an average before upturns. The lag of economic activity appears to be greater for peaks than for troughs. There has been strong secular changes in the money stock over these decades. On the other hand, in deep depression cycles, there has been a greater fall in money stock. But in mild depressions, there has been a reduction in the growth rate of the money stock rather than any actual fall. The usual cycle consists of a contraction phase in which economic activity declines to trough of the cycle, followed by expansion and reaching the peak of the cycle. These cycles are superimposed over a long-run secular growth path, GP, as shown in Figure 10. Again, I will not be explaining the Figure 10. On the basis of the above analysis, Friedman and Schwartz point towards two propositions. First, appreciable changes in the growth rate of the money stock are necessary and sufficient conditions for appreciable changes in the growth rate of economic activity or money income. Second, this is true both for long secular changes and also for changes over periods, roughly the length of business cycles. They further observe that a secular change in the growth rate of the money stock leading to a longer period changes in money income are reflected mainly in different price behavior rather than in different growth rates of output. On the other hand, a short period change in the growth rate of money stock also exerts a substantial influence on the growth rate of output. The greater stability of the money multiplier, in contrast to the Keynesian investment multiplier, has led Friedman and Schwartz to come to the above conclusion. According to them, substantial contractions in the quantity of money over shorter periods have been a major factor in producing severe economic contractions. Cyclical variations in the quantity of money may well be an important element in the ordinary mild business cycle. Next, Friedman and Schwartz explain the mechanism which brings about monetary changes leading to the business cycles. They begin their explanation of the transmission mechanism with a state of moving equilibrium in which real per capita income, the stock of money, and the price level are changing at constant annual rates. Suppose the central bank increases the stock of money in the market by open market operations by purchasing securities. The non-bank sellers and commercial banks will try to readjust their portfolios. The commercial banks will create more money with increase in their reserves, thereby transmitting the increase in high-powered stock of money. On the other hand, the non-bank holders of cash will seek to purchase other categories of securities such as high-risk fixed coupons, equities, real property, etc. Page 355. This will bid up prices of such assets. As the process continues, the initial impacts will spread throughout the economy. The increased demand for assets will spread sooner or later, affecting equities, houses, durable producer goods, durable consumer goods, etc. All these will bid up the prices of assets and of both producer and consumer goods. People will tend to consume more services, such as renting houses rather than purchasing them. This will tend to raise service prices. These effects will raise interest rates on the whole range of assets. Ultimately, expenditures rise on all directions without any change in interest rates at all. Interest rates and asset prices may simply be conduit through which monetary change is transmitted through the expenditures without being altered at all. Just as a greater inflow into a tank may after an interval simply increase the rate of outflow without altering the level of the tank itself. All these forces operate simultaneously and there are cyclical fluctuations. This explanation of the transmission mechanism fits with empirical observations of business cycles. Initially, the rise in the growth rate of money stock occurs early in the contraction phase. Its first impact is on the financial markets, where first bonds, then equities, and only later on payments for real resources will be affected. The financial markets tend to revive well before the trough. This is what has happened historically. The dynamic process of transmission from one equilibrium path to another involves a cyclical adjustment process. Exogenous fluctuations in the money stock will lead to fluctuations in the demand for goods and services. In addition, there may be an endogenous cycle. A rise in demand raises prices. If there is a lag in the adjustment of real money balances to the new price level, the initial portfolio adjustment will tend to overshoot. The initial rise in demand will thus be followed by a fall in demand. The result will be a damped cycle. According to Friedman, the lag plays an important role in business cycles. The amplitude of economic fluctuation depends first on the amplitude, time pattern, number, and independence of disturbances affecting the economic system. Second, on the reaction mechanism of the economic system to the disturbances. The lag may be long because the effects of monetary disturbances are distributed over an extended period. A long lag may mean a larger damping of disturbances than a short lag. Hence, there is a smaller amplitude of resulting fluctuations. The lags in economic activity behind peaks and troughs in the rate of change of money stock are not uniform. Friedman concludes on the basis of empirical evidence that lags involving changes in the rate of money stock that affect the level of economic activity are both long and variable. Its criticisms. Economists have criticized Friedman's theory of money and business cycles on the following grounds. 1. Monetary change is not the only cause of changes in economic activity. Friedman argues that it is monetary changes that cause changes in the economic activity. But critics point out that the direction of causation is just the opposite of it. It is changes in the level of business activity which causes changes in the growth rate of money stock. 2. Monetary change is not the main cause of business cycles. According to this theory, monetary changes are the main cause of business cycles. But in reality, business cycles are the result of other exogenous factors like innovations. Monetary changes may be one among other factors and not the only factor. 3. Time lag of peaks and troughs not long and variable. According to Friedman, the time lag of peaks and troughs in the rate of change of money stock relative to economic changes in business cycles is both long and variable. Professor Culbertson regards this evidence as faulty for two reasons. First, it relates turning points in one series in the money stock to turning points in economic activity. Second, it implies that monetary change has been an exogenous variable and that causation runs only from a monetary change to economic change. In fact, causation, also has run in other direction. Despite these criticisms, it cannot be denied that one of the important causes of business cycles is a dance of the dollar. 11. Calder's model of the trade cycle. Nicholas Calder, note 17, A Model of the Trade Cycle, E.J., March 1940. Nicholas Calder built a model of trade cycle based on the Keynesian terminology of saving and investment. Page 356. He showed that the cycle is the result of pressures that push the economy towards the equality of ex ante, that is, anticipated, expected, or planned saving and investment. In fact, it is the difference between ex ante saving and investment that leads to a cycle. Calder shows the stability and instability conditions in the form of linear diagrams, though the cycle is only possible when I and S are non-linear. Take figure 11a and b, where I and S are equal at the equilibrium level of income Y0. So we have figure 11a and b. In figure 11a and b, both Y is on the x-axis and I and S are on the y-axis. In figure a, S is a straight line which is at a very small angle to the x-axis, starting at a certain point on the y-axis. The I curve is a straight line starting at a point on the x-axis and at a much higher angle. Both of them meet at a certain point corresponding to Y0 income. In figure B, we have I is a straight line with a small angle to the x-axis which starts from the y-axis, and S is a line with a larger angle starting at a certain point on the x-axis. Both of them meet at a point corresponding to income Y0. So basically in both the diagrams, I and S are interchanged. Returning to the text. But in each case, there is a single equilibrium position. In panel A of the figure, where I is greater than S, there is an unstable equilibrium position beyond Y0, because such a situation will lead to limitless expansion, to full employment and hyperinflation. On the other hand, if S is greater than I, it means a downward movement to the left of Y0, which will lead to zero output and employment and to collapse of the economy, as shown in panel B of the figure. Calder discards linear saving and investment functions because they fail to produce a cycle. Instead, he adopts non-linear saving and investment functions. A non-linear investment function I is shown in figure 12. So in figure 12, the investment function is such that it is slightly flat in the beginning, then it rises sharply up to a certain point, and then it again flattens down. So it is like an S. As the economy moves into the expansion phase, shown by the movement from the left along the I curve, the curve is almost flat. It means that there is excess capacity at a low level of income and the net investment is zero. But when expansion gets underway, the negative effect of accumulated capital is a more powerful influence for investment decisions than the higher level of output and profit. In the opposite case of a high level of income, when the economy moves into the contraction phase, the I curve is again flat and the net investment is small, because rising costs of construction, increasing costs and increasing difficulty of borrowing will dissuade entrepreneurs from expanding still faster. This slows down the rate of increase in output. It means that the existing capital stock and the capacity are more than the current output. This leads to decline in further investment. Thus, income falls and the cumulative effect is that the economy moves into the contraction phase. Similarly, a non-linear saving function is shown in figure 13. So, in this figure, first there is a slight rise, then there is a nearly flat stage curve, and then the curve again rises very sharply. So, at the very low level of income, saving is much reduced and may have been negative. So, during the expansion phase, the MPS is large. At normal levels of income, saving will increase at a smaller rate. This is shown by the middle range of the S-curve. But at very high income levels, saving will be absolutely large and people will save a large proportion of their income. The cycle is visible when the non-linear saving and investment curves are brought together as in figure 14. So in figure 14, we have again Y on the X-axis, I and S on the Y-axis, and the curve is a overlapping of the I and S curve. So they meet at three points. One is Y1, that is point A. One is Y2, which is point C, that is in the center. And the other is Y3, corresponding to point B. Y1 is less than Y2 is less than Y3. Returning to the text, the figure shows multiple equilibria at positions A, B and C. Of course, A and B are stable positions and C an unstable position. Between positions C and B and below position A, I is greater than S. This will lead to the rise in the income level. Between positions A and C and above position B, S is greater than I. This will lead to the fall in income. But A and B are stable only in the short run. It is only in the long run that they become unstable and the path of the cycle is visible. For this, Calder introduces the capital stock as another variable that affects the relationship between saving and investment. Page 357. He takes both saving and investment as functions of income and capital stock so that S is a function of Y and K, I is a function of Y and K, and ds upon dy is greater than 0, ds upon dk is greater than 0. Di upon dy is greater than 0, di upon dk is less than 0, and di upon dy is greater than ds upon dy. That is, MPI is greater than MPS over the expansion or contraction phase of the cycle. The above relationships show that both S and I vary positively with Y. While S varies directly with K and I varies inversely with K, the relationship MPI greater than MPS shows the instability of the economy, which will move it either towards expansion or contraction. In terms of figure 14, positions A and B are switch positions in the long run. They are the points at which the economy alters its direction either towards expansion or contraction. Point C is unstable in both positions. It is only when points C and B come closer, the expansion phase of the cycle starts. When they are joined, expansion stops and contraction begins. On the contrary, when C and A come closer, contraction starts. When they are joined, contraction stops and expansion begins. Expansion phase. Calder shows the expansion phase of his trade cycle in three stages as shown in figure 13. So in figure 13 we have three figures, stage 1, stage 2 and stage 3, which I am going to not explain, so you will have to refer to the digitized version. Starting from position Y0 in figure stage 1, which is the same as figure 13, suppose the economy is in equilibrium at point C. But this is the point of unstable equilibrium. An upward displacement shows that I is greater than S, which leads to the economy towards the expansion path. As the rate of investment is high, the economy's capital stock increases at a rapid rate. But as the capital stock increases, the MEC declines and investment curve shifts downward. At the same time, as the economy's capital stock increases, it raises the income of the economy, thereby raising its saving. Thus, the saving curve shifts upwards. So, a downward shift in the investment curve I and the upward shift in the saving curve S brings the center point C nearer to B, as shown in figure stage 2. This process of the downward shifting of the I curve and the upward shifting of the S curve continues till the two curves are tangential and points B and C coincide as shown in figure stage 3. But at this position, S is greater than I in both the directions. So this is an unstable equilibrium position in the downward direction. This leads to the downward movement of the economy till point A is reached in stage 3. Contraction phase. The contraction phase of the trade cycle is also shown in 3 stages as in figure 16. Again, I will not be explaining this figure. We start from position Y1 corresponding to point A in stage 4 of the figure. It is a point of short run stable equilibrium but at a very low income level. Page 358. But over the long run, at such a low level of income, the capital stock decreases due to excess capacity and the investment curve I shifts upwards. Simultaneously, savings fall, which shifts the saving curve downward. Thus, the shifting of the I curve upward and of the S curve downward bring positions A and C nearer as shown in stage 5. This process will continue gradually till I and S curves are tangential and positions A and C coincide, as in the stage 6 figure. But this A plus C position at Y1 income level is unstable in the upward direction because I is greater than S. This will lead to an expansionary process till the economy reaches the higher level of income Y2 at point B. From B, the I and S curves gradually reach the positions shown in stage 1 of figure 15, and again the cyclical process starts. Thus, Calder's cyclical process is self-generating. According to Calder, the forces which bring about the lower turning point are not so certain at the higher level. A boom left to itself is certain to come to an end, but the depression might get into a position of stationariness and remain there until external changes, that is, the discovery of new inventions or of the opening up of new markets, come to the rescue. Further, cycles in the Calder model are not necessarily of the same length and duration. Neither are expansions and contractions necessarily symmetrical. In fact, these depend upon the slopes of the I and the S curve and the rate at which they shift in each phase of the cycle. Calder neither uses the acceleration principle nor the monetary factors in explaining his theory of trade cycle. At the same time, he demonstrates how a cycle could exist in the absence of any growth factor. Measures to control business cycles or stabilization policies. Various measures have been suggested and put into practice from time to time to control fluctuations in an economy. They aim at stabilizing economic activity so as to avoid the ill effects of a boom and a depression. The following 3 measures are adopted for this purpose. 1. Monetary policy. Monetary policy as a method to control business fluctuations is operated by the central bank of a country. The central bank adopts a number of methods to control the quantity and quality of credit. To control the expansion of money supply during a boom, it raises its bank rate, sells securities in the open market, raises the reserve ratio, and adopts a number of selective credit control measures such as raising margin requirements and regulating consumer credit. Thus, the central bank adopts a dear money policy. Borrowings by business and trade become dearer, difficult, and selective. Efforts are made to control excess money supply in the economy. To control a recession or depression, the central bank follows an easy or cheap monetary policy by increasing the reserves of commercial banks. It reduces the bank rate and interest rates of the banks. It buys securities in the open market. It lowers margin requirements on loans and encourages banks to lend more to consumers, businessmen, traders, etc. Page 359. Limitations of monetary policy. But monetary policy is not so effective as to control a boom and a depression. If the boom is due to cost push factors, it may not be effective in controlling inflation, aggregate demand, output, income, and employment. So far as depression is concerned, the experience of the Great Depression of 1930s tells us that when there is pessimism among businessmen, the success of monetary policy is practically nil. In such a situation, they do not have any inclination to borrow even when the interest rate is very low. Similarly, consumers who are faced with reduced incomes and unemployment cut down their consumption expenditure. Neither the central bank nor the commercial banks are able to induce businessmen and consumers to raise the aggregate demand. Thus, the success of monetary policy to control economic fluctuations is severely limited. 2. Fiscal policy. Monetary policy alone is not capable of controlling business cycles. It should therefore be supplemented by compensatory fiscal policy. Fiscal measures are highly effective for controlling excessive government expenditure, personal consumption expenditure, and private and public investment during a boom. On the other hand, they help in increasing government expenditure, personal consumption expenditure, and private and public investment during a depression. Policy during boom. The following measures are adopted during a boom. During a boom, the government tries to reduce unnecessary expenditure on non-development activities in order to reduce its demand for goods and services. This also puts a check on private expenditure, which is dependent on the government demand for goods and services. But it is difficult to cut government expenditure. Moreover, it is not possible to distinguish between essential and non-essential government expenditure. Therefore, this measure is supplemented by taxation. To cut personal expenditure, the government raises the rates of personal, corporate, and commodity taxes. The government also follows the policy of having a surplus budget when the government revenues exceed expenditures. This is done by increasing the tax rates or reduction in government expenditure or both. This tends to reduce income and aggregate demand through the reverse operation of the multiplier. Another fiscal measure which is usually adopted is to borrow more from the public, which has the effect of reducing the money supply with the public. Further, the repayment of public debt should be stopped and postponed to some future date when the economy stabilizes. Policy during depression. During a depression, the government increases public expenditure, reduces taxes, and adopts a budget deficit policy. These measures tend to raise aggregate demand, output, income, employment, and prices. An increase in the public expenditure increases the aggregate demand for goods and services and leads to increase in income via the multiplier. The public expenditure is made on such public works as roads, canals, dams, parks, schools, hospitals, and other construction works. They create demand for labor and the products of private construction industries and helps in reviving them. The government also increases its expenditure on such relief measures as unemployment insurance and other social security measures in order to stimulate the demand for consumer goods industries. Borrowing by the government to finance budget deficits utilizes idle money lying with the banks and financial institutions for investment purposes. Conclusion. The effectiveness of anti-cyclical fiscal policy depends upon proper timing of policy action and the nature and volume of public works and their planning. 3. Direct controls. The aim of direct controls is to ensure proper allocation of resources for the purpose of price stability. They are meant to affect strategic points of the economy. They affect particular consumers and producers. They are in the form of rationing, licensing, price and wage controls, export duties, exchange controls, quotas, monopoly control, etc. They are more effective in overcoming bottlenecks and shortages arising from inflationary pressures. Their success depends on the existence of an efficient and honest administration. Otherwise, they lead to black marketing, corruption, long queues, speculation, etc. Therefore, they should be resorted to only in emergencies like war, crop failures, and hyperinflation. Page 360. Conclusions. Of the various instruments of stabilization policy, no single method is sufficient to control cyclical fluctuations. Therefore, all methods should be used simultaneously. This is because monetary policy is easy to apply but less effective, while fiscal measures and direct controls are difficult to operate but are more effective. Since cyclical fluctuations are inherent in the capitalist system, they cannot be eliminated completely. Some fluctuations may be beneficial for economic growth and others may be undesirable. Stabilization policy should therefore control undesirable fluctuations. We conclude with Keynes. The right remedy for the trade cycles is not to be found in abolishing booms and thus keeping us permanently in a semi-slump, but in abolishing slumps and thus keeping us permanently in a quasi-boom. Selected readings: J. A. Este, Business Cycles; G. Haberler, Prosperity and Depression; J. A. Schumpeter, Business Cycles, 1939; D. Hamburg, Business Cycles, 1937; S. Bober, The Economics of Cycles and Growth, 1968. Exercises. Question 1. What do you mean by a business cycle? Explain its various phases. 2. Give the meaning, phases and effects of a business cycle. 3. Discuss critically the view that trade cycle is purely monetary phenomenon. 4. Critically examine Schumpeter's theory of innovations as the explanation of cyclical fluctuations. 5. Discuss the view that trade cycle is mainly due to fluctuations in marginal efficiency of capital. 6. Discuss critically Samuelson's model of trade cycles. 7. Show that the interaction of the multiplier and accelerator provides a satisfactory explanation of the trade cycle. 8. Critically discuss the Hicksian theory of the trade cycle. 9. Explain Calder's model of the trade cycle. 10. Discuss Goodwin's model of the trade cycle and compare it with Hicks' model. 11. Discuss Friedman's monetary theory of the trade cycle. And 12. What is a business cycle? Explain its characteristics. How can a business cycle be controlled? With this, we come to the end of chapter 38. We have reached the end of part 5.